On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The bombing and shooting and dying are not over, and political leaders are still talking about the necessity of success. But in high-level strategic circles, there is plenty of talk that America has already lost the war in Iraq. My guest today, a grand strategy guru at the U.S. Naval War College, takes that as a given, American defeat. And when the whole country wakes up to that, he says, there is going to be hell to pay, an Iraq syndrome that could make America's post-Vietnam blues look like peanuts. We don't wish it, but odds are, he says, it's coming. Up next on Point, get ready for the post-Iraq world. But first, we go to Baghdad on the day after the big bombings of a Shiite holy site in Samarra. John Ward Anderson is a reporter for The Washington Post. John, thank you very much for joining us. What's been the mood there on the day after this huge bombing of the minarets in Samarra?
You know, there's been some scattered demonstrations around the country in some of the big cities in Najaf and Basra, some demonstrations actually here in Baghdad, despite the curfew over in Sadr City, which has economy anyway. But, you know, for the most part, the visceral backlash that we saw after the last time that this shrine was hit in February 2006 hasn't happened. There hasn't been the massive wave of sectarian violence, although there have been a few strikes at some Sunni mosques around the country. But no massive wave at this point of sectarian anger.
It's only about a day and a half since the minarets came down. Of course, last year when the Golden Dome at the same site was blown, it unleashed an enormous sectarian backlash. Tens of thousands died. Here we are a day and a half later. Is there some confidence that things have changed, that there won't be a backlash this time? Shiite on Sunni or what, John?
Could be that things have changed. I mean, remember the attack in February 2006 was one of the very first big attacks against a religious shrine, and I think people at that point were stunned, and there was sort of a really emotional outburst. This time, we've gone through almost another year and a half where, I mean, I hate to say it, but attacks on religious structures have become more or less routine. And so I think people have become a little bit immune to the idea that they need to go out and strike back when a shrine has been hit. And in fact, the religious leaders, the political leaders, there's been a unified voice saying, don't strike back, don't rise to the bait, and don't let this get out of control into another cycle of sectarian bloodshed.
It's awfully early to say, but do you see that as a hopeful sign that the kind of reconciliation between Shiites and Sunnis that U.S. generals say they have to make progress there may in fact be happening? Is this in fact positive evidence in that quadrant?
I don't want to climb out on that limb to tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. I think it's less evidence of reconciliation than it is of fatigue. I see very little sign. There's very little sign of reconciliation here. There are all sorts of political moves that are underway, but that are basically not going anywhere. There's really no progress on a lot of the political reconciliation that people are trying to achieve. What there is, though, I think after a war that's lasted 4 years, that's maybe killed as many as 65,000 people, I think there's fatigue. People are tired of the killing. They're tired of living without electricity. They're tired of sitting on the third largest oil revenues in the world, having to wait 5 hours for gasoline. There's just fatigue.
John, we're going to talk in a moment with a professor at the U.S. Naval War College who's saying, look, big outline here, more than heavy odds, we've lost this war, and we're going to have to get used to it. Do you hear an echo of that among U.S. troops, officers in Iraq? Are they articulating anything like that, or is it still gung-ho, we're going to hang in, we're going to be successful?
I think the question among the senior officers here is how to leave. Nobody wants to admit defeat and go home with their tail between their legs. I mean, I think they figure that, you know, we came in here on a plan that wasn't very well thought out. If we're going to leave, we need to leave with an idea of what we want to happen and not just go out and leave it to utter chaos.
Well, there's the word from in the barracks in the officers' quarters. John Ward Anderson in Baghdad, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
John Ward Anderson, correspondent there for The Washington Post. We are looking this hour at what might be the blowback from an all-too-possible U.S. defeat in Iraq. Joining me now from Providence, Rhode Island, is Christopher Fettweiss, assistant professor of national security affairs and a specialist in grand strategy at the U.S. Naval War College. He recently published a tough essay in the Los Angeles Times headline, Post-Traumatic Iraq Syndrome. His forthcoming book is Angel Triumphant, International Politics of Great Power Peace. Christopher Fettweiss, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Tom.
So you've lifted a curtain here on a pretty ugly scenario, and I wish you'd walk us through this essay a little bit meticulously. You open up sort of preparing us for what's going to come. Your first line is, losing hurts more than winning feels good, and you go right on from there. Lay out what you've got to say in this essay, Professor.
Well, I guess I had a couple points as it unfolded, and the first one, as you said, was sort of borrowing some wisdom from that amateur philosopher and baseball Hall of Famer, Sparky Anderson, who once said that, or is credited with saying, that losing hurts twice as bad as winning feels good.
Whether it's sports or finance or love or war, you say.
And I think there's something to that. Whether you're talking, if you think about the great sports events of your life, the losses seem to hurt and haunt you more than the victories make you feel good.
You say defeat in war damages societies quite out of proportion to what a rational calculation of cost would predict.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's true. And I think you don't have to look too much further back than Vietnam to think. In Vietnam, the losses, the material losses to the United States were fairly minimal. We didn't have, there were no dominoes that fell. I mean, Laos and Cambodia fell, but they were even more irrelevant than Vietnam. Nothing much happened in the overall Cold War balance of power, but the consequences for the U.S. domestic politics were quite profound. Because lose people are haunted by loss.
All that,
whether it's a right? love or money or in a big sense, war.
And that haunting and what may come of it is what you're focused on here. All that's hypothetical sort of and historical, but then you get very current. And you say, you write, the end game in Iraq is now clear. We're paying attention to you. You're at the Naval War College. You say it appears that the heavily favored United States will be upset. Now, everything else you write hinges on that, so make your case for that. You're talking about U.S. loss here. Nobody likes to do that. The charges of defeatism fly fast and furious in the political realm when you touch that rail. Here you are at the Naval War College. You're saying it. Why?
Well, I'm saying it for a couple reasons, and I ought to put out at first, of course, the standard disclaimer that these are my thoughts and the thoughts of no one else. But
not no one else. I'm looking through the clips here. You're not the only one who's thinking and talking about this, but with reference to the Naval War College, we've got it. Okay.
Absolutely. There seems to be no historical examples that I'm aware of that a democracy is able to sustain a war in the face of popular discontent. When the people turn against a war, eventually a democracy has to pull out. It can't sustain it. And obviously, the last few months, every single poll, the last couple of years, has now had about 2/3 of the American people think not only that this war is not worth fighting, but that we should start pulling out. So the end is not determined, but the overall outline of it is clear, because there's also no example that I know of, and I'd be happy to be proven wrong, because obviously I take no joy out of any of this. But there is no example of a modern democracy changing its mind once it has turned against a war.
Even when the stakes are as high as this one, even with people like John McCain saying to the country, we cannot lose this. We cannot strategically lose this. Even then, the country won't change its mind?
I'm not sure the country believes him, and I think the country's probably fairly right in that, which we can get into a little later. But I don't think people believe that it was worthwhile, that it is worthwhile. Whether or not that's right or not, it doesn't particularly matter. And I think I should say, too, that I don't think it's particularly appropriate to be talking about war in terms of loss and victory, and as if it were a cribbage match or a football game. Winning and losing is not particularly appropriate, especially when we're talking about a guerrilla war like this. It's going to be blurry. It's going to be gray.
Blurry, but yet it's your word. You say we ought to come to grips with the meaning of losing, your word.
Right.
In Iraq.
Right. Exactly, because it doesn't matter what I think, if it's appropriate or not. That is irrelevant, because people will interpret it as a loss, whether or not I don't think it's appropriate, but that doesn't matter. People look upon war in terms of defeat and victory. And if it unfolds as it appears it will, people will see it as a loss. And the consequences for our domestic politics and our sort of national psyche, if you will, are going to be out of proportion to any material consequences for the United States, which I think are likely to be fairly minimal.
You say
we can talk about that.
We will indeed. You say the consequences for the national psyche are likely to be profound, throwing American politics into a downward spiral of bitter recrimination, the likes of which it has not seen in a generation. Like what?
The defeat has to be explained, and blame has to be placed. The coach can be fired, or you can trade your third baseman if you're a baseball team or football team. But the in war, somebody has to have been wrong, and we have to, and the fingers are going to be pointed about what went wrong with this war, why the United States lost. It has to be explained, and we see that in Vietnam. People blame the media, the generals, the South Vietnamese, the American soldier. People point, or the lefties on campuses. People point fingers in all directions, trying to explain why we lost. Because once you understand why, it becomes easier to live with on some level. It wasn't a fault of the United States, who are still a great country, but we now can understand why we lost, to in order to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Christopher Fettweiss.
In order for us to come to some peace with it, we have to learn lessons from defeat in a way you don't have to learn lessons from victory.
Professor Fettweiss, you say the battle for interpretation of the war will be fierce, and it's already begun. Where do you see it?
I see it in hastily written memoirs that are coming out, and everybody pointing fingers at various directions. Officials that were very decisive in propagating the war in the beginning, or its execution, showing that they weren't at fault, it was other people's, that other people, in effect, screwed up their war. And I think it's very important at this stage, we have the potential to have a conversation in this country after this war is over about the proper use of U.S. power in the world, about the proper grand strategy for the United States. And I think it will get lost. I worry, number one, that it'll get lost in the middle of a political conversation that is going to be absolutely deafening. I bore my students with a lot of things, and one of the things I bore them with over and over is the idea that politics is the enemy of strategy. You cannot have a really productive, thoughtful conversation about strategy in a political atmosphere.
And here we are with the war going wherever it's going in the middle of a presidential campaign, so you are guaranteed to have it in a political atmosphere.
Yeah, that's what worries me.
You write that the war's supporters have staked out a position, a clear position. Attacking Iraq was strategically sound but operationally flawed. Operationally flawed. You're the grand strategy expert. What do you say to that argument?
I am glad you brought that up, because that's the interpretation of the war that I think is most dangerous, to think that it was the right thing to do, but done ineffectively, with not enough troops, debathification too early, not coming in from the north, the Iraqis let us down, the media stabbed us in the back. None of that matters. None of that is particularly relevant. The war itself was the mistake, and that's the main lesson that ought to be coming in this debate that we're going to have, this national conversation, after this war is effectively over. That the war, this crusade itself was a mistake, and unfortunately titled early on a crusade. But either way, if we have a more broad conversation about the use of American power, we may come to the conclusion, hopefully, that this kind of thing wouldn't be the kind of thing that the Founding Fathers, for instance, would have preferred us to do, things we should not be doing.
A fundamental mistake, you're saying, then. You say historians will certainly agree that the war was a catastrophic mistake. So a mistake in what dimensions?
It has the potential to be a catastrophic mistake, I think I wrote. I mean, I am sort of an optimist by heart, despite what I might be saying now, and I don't think it's going to be too catastrophic, but it has the potential to be worse than Vietnam. Because Vietnam, as a lot of what they call the realists were saying before Vietnam, every prominent realist in the 60s was saying, don't do this, Vietnam is strategically irrelevant. And every prominent realist, with the possible exception of Henry Kissinger, before this war was also saying, hey, don't do this. This is not a good idea. This isn't what we should be doing. And we may be coming out of a similar outcome.
You see, the only significant question still hanging is whether Iraq will turn out to have been the biggest strategic mistake in U.S. history. Your word. So again, what's the fundamental strategic mistake you see or saw here?
If it is true that worst-case scenarios do happen, and as many people are now predicting, and this war destabilizes the Middle East, the most crucial region in the world in a lot of ways, then this will have been a far larger strategic mistake than Vietnam or anything we have done before. For decades, the main U.S. goal in the Middle East was stability. And Bush Sr., George Bush 41, as they say in certain strategic circles, fought the first Gulf War in order to maintain stability in the Gulf. And after September 11th, our strategic thinking changed, and we started to think, well, now that stability is unacceptable. And we wanted a new kind of stability, and create some positive momentum toward democracy and freedom in the Middle East. And a lot of realists were saying, look, that's a bad idea. That's going to take a miracle. And unfortunately, in international politics, miracles are rare events. So we should not be surprised that this didn't work out, because it would have taken a miracle.
You call it hopefully neoconservatism's parting gift to America, or maybe the parting gift will be a reconsideration of that strategy as the public and our public life gets focused on what's happened there. But you go to this, you go to Vietnam, and the Vietnam syndrome, it did haunt the country for years. President Bush's father said he finally licked it with the Gulf War. But you go back and say Saigon fell, but no dominoes followed. The balance of Cold War power did not change. So some might say, maybe we can waltz out of Iraq and we'll be fine, thanks.
That's entirely possible. And I sincerely hope that the worst-case scenario that I sort of hinted or alluded to there turns out to be wrong. And by the way, I suspect it will. We tend to overestimate the threats and overestimate the dire consequences of our actions. And I don't think it will be catastrophic when this war comes to a conclusion. If there is an optimism to that we can come take it away from this, I don't think that the terrorists are going to follow us home, for instance, or that the region is going to descend into absolutely unprecedented region-wide war. That's, I still think, fairly unlikely, not impossible. And if that happens, that's why the question is still open. If that happens, this will turn out to be a major strategic disaster. As it is now, it's just perhaps a minor strategic blunder, although the people of Iraq obviously wouldn't feel that way.
Mark is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you today?
Well, okay.
Good. I read Professor Fetway's piece. I think it was very informative, and I think he's right to focus on the contrast between winning and losing, just as I think that one of the lessons we should take out of this to help us in the future is to focus on the cost and the benefit of adventures like this. On the run-up to this war, the benefits were always laid out, but the costs were hidden, and it was a concerted effort to conceal the price of the war. It was off the books. When the bodies came home, they were concealed from the cameras.
Out of sight.
Most Americans think there are about 145,000 troops in Iraq. In fact, there are about 130,000 private contractors who are doing some of the support work and, in some cases, some of the fighting. So we really have the equivalent of almost 275,000 person army.
And 29,000 dead and wounded at this point. That's a big number.
That's right. And so what I hope, are there going to be recriminations? Of course. I hope they're productive recriminations, and they're directed at the people who concealed the true cost. You may remember we were told it was going to be a cakewalk when Shinseki said several hundred thousand troops. Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld said he was wildly off the mark. That's where the recriminations need to go, at the people who underplayed the costs of this war and the news media that failed to publicize them.
Mark, we've got it, and there's a prayer for productive recriminations, if that's what it's going to be, and we'll look at that. Let me get a call from Simsbury, Connecticut. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing? I just wanted to make one point here. I was a military veteran. I joined in 1979.
Yeah.
And the post-Vietnam era, I had a couple of friends call me stupid for going in the military. And I'm afraid after the Iraq War that the same thing is going to happen here. The psyche of the military is going to be damaged for a while. And again, what you said, George Bush Sr. said he did wonders at the next Gulf War to shake the ghost of Vietnam. And I think it's going to be a long time to shake the ghost of Iraq.
Kevin, that's exactly the fear here, and we are going to look at it. Thank you for putting that on the board, and we'll come back to the military ramifications. Let me get a call from Des Moines, Iowa. John, you're on the air, my friend.
Good morning. Thanks for having my call there,
yeah.
Tom. Well, first of all, I appreciate the viewpoint of professor there, but I think that we're kind of missing a bigger issue here.
Okay.
I'm going to draw an analogy first, and then we'll relate it to it. You know, if you've got a kid, he grows up, he's kind of a bully, whatever, you know, his parents try to do the best to raise him and stuff, and if they make college an option for him, but he goes and drinks and doesn't and parties and doesn't take advantage of that, who loses? Do the parents lose or does the kid lose?
So who's the bully boy kid here? Iraq? Iraq is a unruly teenager?
No, Saddam. We did not go over to conquer Iraq. We had no intentions of subjugating that country. We were trying to displace a dictator who had gone into Kuwait, who had disrupted the potential.
But what are you saying now? I mean, John, Saddam is dead. So at this point, are you saying
exactly.
It's not our loss? It's the Iraqis' loss? We're not taking a loss here, if that's what it comes to?
The reason we stayed there beyond Iraq or beyond Saddam was to try and help them set up a democracy so that they could have, you know, democratic principles in the Middle East. And I do think that's a wonderful vision. I think it was somewhat foolhardy at this point in time because the vested interests You know, you look at how many people are Muslim over there who will do anything to keep Western influence from getting a precedent.
But, John, if it doesn't work, if that doesn't work, how do you feel about it? Can we just, you know, smack our hands and walk out and say, well, we gave it our best shot, no problem?
Well, now, I'm probably not going to be very popular with this, but, I mean, I lived through the 70s and the oil embargoes, and I am amazed that our country, that America, and to a lesser degree Europe, you know, didn't take a wake-up call then and say, we have got to get independent from their oil. You know, that's what gives them their power. That's what gives them their money.
Well, that would be great, but we won't be standing there quite immediately, as we can see. But, John, it's an interesting perspective, and Christopher Fettweiss, it is widely articulated now. I mean, just in recent days by politicians in Washington, you know, if it's a loss, it's not our loss, it's their loss. Iraq has failed here, not the U.S.
I think there's a lot to that. I think John is right that we went in to get rid of Saddam Hussein and succeeded in doing that, which I think it would be better if we were to have a conversation in terms of where do we succeed and where do we fail. But that's not how people think about war. And people think about it in terms of winning and losing. And now the war has been, we've let it be defined as the only way we can win is if we leave behind some flourishing Jeffersonian democracy. And if that's victory, that's going to be very difficult to achieve in any level. So I think John is exactly right that we went in there to get rid of Saddam and succeeded. But we didn't realize, and although a lot of people did, that Iraq was a society teetering on the edge of the abyss thanks to decades of Saddam Hussein's misrule and tyrannical policies. And we went in there and pushed it right over. And now we're looking at a completely broken society, which is going to take a long time to put back together, and we have to decide whether it's in our interest to even get in there and do that. And if I could say one quick thing about the second call there, the military ramifications that
yes.
he was concerned about. I think the country's changed in some ways about this. I think we as a nation feel guilty about what happened to the Vietnam vets when they came back and the attitude towards the military in this country in the 70s and 80s, in the early 80s at least. And I think we are quite conscious of that, and there has been very, very little anti-military sentiment in this country. The fingers of blame, when they are pointed at the military, are quite quickly rebutted.
Not anti-military, but yet there's a morale issue, and if it gets interpreted as defeat, that we know from history, that is a tough thing to carry. I want to get a historical perspective here, if I may. David Kennedy joins us from Stanford, California, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of American history, a professor at Stanford University, author of Freedom from Fear and World War I over here. David Kennedy, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you again, Tom.
Post-traumatic Iraq syndrome. You know, you may have seen the headline, "The War is Lost. Americans should begin to deal with what that means." Are you prepared? Are you ready to look at it that way, David Kennedy?
Well, I did read Professor Fettweiss's quite provocative piece. And, I think it's quite likely, to paraphrase and expand upon a famous phrase of General Omar Bradley in a different context, that Iraq will be judged by historians as the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong enemy, fought for the wrong strategic objectives, and fought with the wrongly configured force, and will add up to a really huge catastrophe of the first order.
If all that comes to pass, and we may be on that chute right now. Sometimes I feel like Wile E. Coyote, you know, already out over the canyon, but just not realizing there's nothing under there yet. How do you think this country will deal with that kind of outcome this time, David Kennedy?
Well, all that said, without disagreeing with Professor Fettweiss, I think the first order of debate is going to be how to describe the outcome in Iraq. It will not be victory in any conventional sense. But it's possible, at least, that it could be spun as something less than total and absolute defeat as well. So I think that will be the first order of the day, will be to define the terms by which we describe the outcome. But I think his Professor Fettweiss's larger point is one that really we should focus on, is that whatever the nature of the debate after the exit from Iraq, whatever shape that takes and so on, it's going to confound and confuse a much more necessary debate about the future of American national security policy and foreign policy. And I think there's very little doubt that Iraq has already, and will probably even more so in the future, has alienated two very important constituencies, absolutely indispensable constituencies. One is the network of our friends and allies that we've carefully cultivated for half a century, who are now very disillusioned with us. and disillusioned with our departure from or the weakening of our ties to a whole range of multilateral institutions that we painstakingly put together in the last half century. And the other, of course, and this comes back to Professor Fettweiss's principal point, is that we are in danger of some kind of reversion to a neo-isolationist posture at home, where the American public simply will be so disgusted with all kinds of active internationalist foreign policy that they will refuse to sanction any sort of international presence in the future of the nature that this country conducted after World War II.
And if we get out of that storm in Iraq, Christopher Fettweiss writes, we'll need to be prepared for divisiveness, vitriol, self-doubt, and recrimination. Those will all be the symptoms, he says. Those will be neoconservatism's and the Bush administration's parting gift to America. You've seen the history. What do you expect on the backside of this war, David Kennedy?
Well, you know, it used to be said that the only segment or section of this country that had any experience with military defeat was the South, the post-Civil War South. And that was one of the defining characteristics of the South's regional identity. Yeah. And indeed, to this day, well over a century on from the conclusion of the Civil War, that still constitutes some part of Southern identity, I believe. So these traumas go very, very deep, and they're long-lasting, and they're multi-generational, at least potentially. And we certainly saw something of this nature in the post-Vietnam era. It had real consequences for the configuration of the military, for national security policy, and things like the War Powers Act of 1973, the shift to an all-volunteer force, the so-called total force doctrine that integrated the reserves and the active duty forces in a way that was designed to restrain the executive from more ambitious military policy.
And for American politics, though, a kind of backlash that helped put Ronald Reagan ultimately in the White House.
Well, that's right. And one of the callers just mentioned that the first Gulf War, the Bush 41 war in the Gulf, was thought to have exorcised the ghost of Vietnam. I think that's true in a limited sense, but in a deeper sense, I think even that war could be construed, successful as it was in its own terms, as having some less than healthy consequences.
I want to hear from our listeners, Professors Kennedy and Fettweiss, if you'll stand by for just a moment. Let's invite in a few. Jack in Moline, Illinois, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'd like to respond to what you and your guests are speaking about this morning, about how long it might take post-Iraq to repair, you know, America's reputation.
Mm.
I think there is some confusion about what post-Iraq is going to be. You know, we've talked about Vietnam, we've talked about Korea. You know, Americans don't want another Vietnam. We don't want to see helicopters go over the edges of buildings as we exit Iraq.
Right.
And I don't think it's going to be Korea, because Korea is too friendly. Iraq is a very dangerous place. But I think the world is waiting for U.S. to take leadership. The world is waiting to see the true American spirit come out. And
what would that look like, and what would it mean for Iraq if it did?
Post-Bush, it would look like a U.S. with a humanitarian effort, bringing the U.N., bringing the Arab neighbors, bringing the world as an American cooperative effort.
And you think Al-Qaeda is going to stop bombing mosques and the sectarian violence will end if we bring in the Peace Corps?
Well, Maliki is holding out because he doesn't want to sign the oil revenue bill. The Iraqis are holding out. They're going to keep bombing until the Americans give up on the oil revenue bill. They don't want to give up 75% of their national wealth.
Okay, Jack, let us put that on the boards, and we'll come to it. Change our stripes, and there may be a better way. We'll come to it. Alex is calling from Washington, D.C. Alex, what do you see?
Hi, Alex. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, Cheney was saying in one of these talk shows that we brought all the members of the Iraqi government from Iran because that's where they all used to live. And actually, I go further, the only reason the Iranian government allowed them to live in Iran and go to Iraq was because they worked for the Iranian secret police.
So where are we headed?
Well, I mean, the way it's happened is, you know, we bogged down in Iraq, and nobody believes us about Iran, and we're handing Iraq now to Iran, according to the Cheney. And Mayor Giuliani in the debate was saying that, you know, Iran is the world's biggest sponsor of anti-American terrorism, who's going to give the bomb to its subcontractors.
So if all that is correct and Iraq goes to Iran, that hardly sounds like a victory.
Well, that sounds like we used our military to give a success to the terrorist government in Iran.
Alex, we've got that. Let me go to another call here. Daniel in Somerville, Massachusetts. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi there. Hi. I wanted to ask if a politically polarized nation can ever learn anything from a loss of a war. Thinking about the Vietnam syndrome, I mean, I realized that it was a national depression. There was a lack of military confidence. There was 15 years of military reticence afterward. But I think the real tragedy was that the right and the left never agreed what happened. The right thought the loss of Vietnam was due to hippies and,
right.
and the press and peaceniks, and we should have bombed Hanoi. And the left blamed imperialism and fantasized political philosophies.
Right.
And that right-left syndrome, I think, allowed another war to happen when, you know, the political right finally fully came back to power. So I'm wondering if any Iraq syndrome, again, will be kind of a useless political phase in our history, or will it really do something in some kind of intrinsic way? Will people just think, well, next time we have to elect a commander-in-chief that's a little bit smarter than George Bush?
Smarter, and that is a great and deep question, and we've got it on the boards as well. I'll get one more, and we'll turn to all of this. Gabrielle, you're on the air from Boston. Hi.
Hi, Tom. I think this really follows on the last caller, because I'm responding to the professor and the Iowa caller who talked about getting rid of Saddam Hussein as a victory.
Mm.
And my question or comment, and it's a little of each, is we knew at the time that there had to be repercussions, there would be repercussions. Why was our government not aware and not responding to their own experts in paying attention to the fact that that country was going to fall apart?
What do you think is the answer to that question? What do you think is the answer, Gabriel?
What do I think is the answer?
Yeah.
I think that it was a way of keeping us from the truth. And I think more important than what the government did, what George Bush did, more important than that is what the populace did. People had the information in this country to know, and they did not respond to that. And that is really important. I mean, what is really important going forward is that we act like an electorate that has a half a brain.
Of course, the public is going to be very important again going forward. Christopher Fetwise says the loss of support with that public is the number one reason that this war may well be doomed. All right, we've got a lot on the table. Christopher Fetwise, David Kennedy, let's dive in on these. Professor Fetwise, first with you. Jack, our caller in Illinois, says there's still room for optimism here. We can change our stripes in Iraq, bring in the neighbors, you know, stop shooting, start helping, and pull this thing out. Do you see a chance of that?
I wish I did. I'm not too optimistic about any of the proposals I've heard so far. I'm not sure why the region would want to see anything but an American pullout at this point. The Iranians don't have a whole lot of incentive to see this thing go well, but they don't have an incentive to see Iraq totally implode either. We shouldn't think that they're going to march right in after we march out.
Let me put Alex's point from Washington to you then as well, that an American loss, if that's how it gets framed here, or that if that's what it is an Iranian win.
Yeah, there will be people that will interpret it that way. I don't think we should get too bent out of shape about that. I don't think an Iranian win helps them in the long term any more than a U.S. loss would hurt us in the long term.
Wow.
The interpretation is where I think it was Daniel in Somerville who was saying that it's going to be very difficult to have a conversation about what the meaning was, what actually happened in the political atmosphere we're going to have after this war, because there's going to be so much emotion, and it's going to be so raw, and people are going to be so angry, and it's going to be very difficult to really have any kind of agreement, and which is why we're going to have a very divisive, very vitriolic political discussion.
Oh, boy.
And which will just obliterate any kind of coherent strategic discussion that we would have been able to have.
We're going to root for that coherent discussion and try to bring it on. But David Kennedy, what about it? Daniel's point in Somerville, Massachusetts, listening there in Stanford, California, you know, he sees after Vietnam this gigantic left-right gulf opening up, polarization, never could agree on the war, and then couldn't agree on much of anything else either. Do you see a repeat of that post-Iraq or some other dynamics coming in here?
Well, I think the post-Iraq situation, unfortunately, has the potential to be even worse than the post-Vietnam situation. I mean, perversely enough, the conclusion of the Vietnam War actually stabilized and solidified what we might call the environing structure of international relations or the international system at the time, which went by the name of the Cold War. And we got détente, and we got a certain stabilization of that regime. There's no such environing structure here. And indeed, much of the confusion and contradiction and murkiness about why we went into Iraq in the first place, what were really the stated reasons and the real reasons for being there, that debate is still not resolved, and it wasn't clear at the time. So there's going to be a much messier debate, it seems to me, about the meaning of Iraq, why it was undertaken in the first place, what the consequences are. And we don't have, unfortunately, a kind of agreed international strategic structure that we and others believe in as a way of making sense out of this event. So I believe anti-terrorism, for example, is no kind of grand strategy. And we don't have a grand strategic structure in place in which we can make sense out of this event.
So set aside the grand world structure, what about American politics? I mean, Fareed Zakaria has got the cover story in Newsweek coming out next week. And it's how to restore America's place in the world. He looks at Rudy Giuliani, you know, telling audiences all around the country, they hate you. They want to kill you. You know, he says, this is really dangerous. This is a furtherance of the path that we've been on. But yet it's out there. And a lot of people are going to that. Do you see a right-left divide again, David Kennedy, or some new political configuration in this country? Maybe even unity, because the stakes look so high.
Well, I do think Zakaria has it right, and he's not the only one to say this, that the challenge for the next administration, whoever it is, whatever party it is going to be to extricate ourselves from the Iraq situation in such a way that does not further damage and dismantle the structure of international institutions that we've helped to build up and the confidence of our own people that our leadership know what they're doing in foreign policy and national security policy. I think there are some very, very significant things at high risk here.
Christopher Fettweiss, our caller Gabrielle in Boston, comes right around full circle to the American people and says, you know, there was support for this war. So, and now you point to the falling away of that support as the number one reason for failure. If that's where we're headed, what about the American public? How should they be sort of scratching their own heads, you know, after we kick the administration for doing it or for doing it wrong and kick the neocons for lighting the way? Where should we, could we kick ourselves? What needs to be learned here, you know, at large?
Well, I don't think we should be spending too much time kicking the American people too much. This was, you know, remember a couple of years ago, September 11th was still pretty fresh in everyone's mind, and I think this would never have happened without September 11th happening before it. And so that doesn't excuse, obviously, what had happened, but you have to understand or remember at the same time, there were very few people in any part of the political spectrum anyway that opposed the war very vociferously or very, very strongly.
But sobriety is still important, even in times of crisis. I burned the house down because I was mad. I mean, we may face more terrorism. We can't afford to just go popping off in anger or emotion when the stakes are this high.
I think that's very well said, and I think one of the big dangers in policy making is when policy is made based on emotion. President Clinton used to say that when he looks back, not only fatigue, but things, his worst decisions were made in isolation based on emotion. And in general, when you make foreign policy choices based on emotion, that's going to lead to disaster, or you have a high probability of it leading to disaster. And perhaps after the Vietnam syndrome eventually came to an end. It might be a generational thing, but the Iraq syndrome will as well. And we'll be able to eventually have a conversation about how to use American power in the world that we won't be able to in its immediate aftermath.
Wow, but that's eventually with a capital E. I mean, these are generational terms you're talking, and eventually, as the great one said, we'll all be dead. Steve's calling from Camden, South Carolina. Steve, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I can't understand why the United States, or at least our leadership, can't figure out something that basically all of our enemies have figured out. And that fact is that you don't have to beat the United States militarily. All you have to do is play a psychological game and keep the war dragging on, and eventually we'll get tired and go home. And, I mean, it worked in Vietnam, it's working now, and why we can't figure that out, I don't understand. Thank you.
We got it. Yep, Steve, thank you very much. Christopher Fettweiss, how about it? I mean, there will be lessons learned in this country. There will be lessons learned abroad already. How do you see those playing out? And what about Steve's point?
I think Steve's point's a good one and a widely thought one, but I don't believe at all that the United States does not have the ability to fight wars if we see it to be important. I think the big point of this war, the public support fell away because we started asking, what are we doing this for? we are not going to be able to drum up popular support for the in the long term for unnecessary wars. And rightly or wrongly, this one is seen as an unnecessary war.
But even if the reason to go to war fell away once we got there, once you're sitting on top of the world's oil patch, I mean, is it not important? You're talking about a risk of regional meltdown right on top of the core resource that the world economy runs on these days. Now, like that or hate it, that's the way the world works. That's not important?
Oh, it's very important. And it's important especially a short-term regional meltdown would obviously be catastrophic in the short term. But whoever wins, and this is a point that Professor Kennedy mentioned a little bit ago about the possibility of a return towards sort of an isolationist sentiment in this country. I don't think necessarily that would be so bad, because whoever wins, whether it's some kind of Iranian-dominated region, some kind of, you know, hopefully some sort of democratic Iraq in some level, whoever wins needs to sell the oil. They need to sell it, and we need to buy it. So in the long run, everything is going to be fine. And oil does nobody any good in the ground.
Boy, that long run is a scary long run, though. David Kennedy, there's a couple of giant points there. Number one, Stephen, South Carolina says, lesson learned here, the U.S. doesn't have the psychological, you know, stick-to-itiveness to win a war. And then the idea that in the long run, you know, we'll be fine. What do you say to those?
Well, I think, in fact, in the Iraq War, the United States did win the conventional military victory and won it quite handily in a matter of days, really. So that conventional terms, the way these things are usually measured, it was a victory, and that mission accomplished business and so on the aircraft carrier was, in its own terms, quite accurate.
But in a way, it feels like, so what? It just turned to hell
after that. Exactly. And I'm actually just reading a terrifically insightful book by a retired British general called The Utility of Force. His name is Rupert Smith. Mm. And the key word in the title is utility, that one needs to have force configured in such a way that it actually achieves the stated objective and not just overwhelm the enemy and then you're set saddled with the problem of long-term occupation of a sullen and resentful nation, which is exactly the situation we're in. So I think Professor Fedewis is pointing to the future where we're going to have a searching debate about the whole palette of foreign policy, national security tools and instruments that we have, the configuration of the armed forces, the balance between so-called soft power and hard power. This needs to be a really serious and deep debate, and I hope we can have it in a context other than a lot of bitter recrimination.
We've got just half a minute, so this is unfair, but Christopher Fetwise says he would welcome a little isolationism on the U.S. part. Can we do that in a period of globalization and be successful?
Well, if by isolationism we mean an increasing reluctance on the part of the American people to deploy conventional military force as our preferred instrument of foreign policy, I think that would be a healthy thing.
Wow. Do you see it coming, Christopher Fetwise? Well, we have a choice. Is our military so beaten up that we're going to have to sit back for a while here and restore?
We'll certainly have a choice. Whether or not the choice is going to be made wisely, I don't know. And I think Professor Kent is exactly right. And nobody says we should be retreating behind walls and stopping trade and eschewing our moral responsibilities. But we can start defining what is truly in our interest a little bit more narrowly, and we'd probably be a little bit better off in the long run.
Mm. There's a great big vista that may not be fun to live through, but we're facing it right now with both of you. Christopher Fetwise, Assistant Professor of National Security Affairs at the U.S. Naval War College, author of the forthcoming Angel Triumphant. Professor Fetwise, thank you very much for being with us
today. Thank you, sir.
And David Kennedy, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian of American history, professor of history at Stanford University, author of Freedom from Fear and World War I over here. David Kennedy, always great to have you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.